Soon may the editing come to discontinue the Tazo Sun. One day when the CRP's done, we'll take our leave and go.
Callum, you're positively fissing with excitement over there. Everything all right?
Things are great. I would say that perhaps their level of enthusiasm has started to fizzle out because we're now a few weeks out from Fizz conference.
And yet here we are, creating more and more content for the loyal listeners who were not able to attend.
We'll keep fiddling on about it, fizzling on it. No, effervescent con.
Let's just cut it there. So yes, we were at the FIS 2023, the Federation of Infection Societies, put on by the Microbiology Society in Edinburgh, the greatest city of them all. The last couple of episodes, we've had some FIS highlights from other people, and you took a few minutes to have a nice little monologue all to yourself in the last episode.
Did you listen to that?
Yeah, I listened to them all.
Are you a loyal listener, Jim?
Yes, I need to get that hot idiot's content every fortnight or sometimes longer when we forget or we're on holiday. But no, you and me haven't chatted about how we enjoyed FIS. So how did you enjoy FIS, Callum?
I thought FIS was great. The conference was great. It was well organized. You see, one of the things that I find a lot going to conferences, and I've been to more conferences in the last 2 years than I'd ever been to before, is that there's always an expectation that the IT or the audio or something won't work. And it seemed very well organized. It seemed very slick.
Yeah, right. I agree. People have got their hands sort of hybrid and non-local hosting, and obviously the Edinburgh Conference Centre, which is where it was held. FIS has been there a few times now, and it always seems to be run very smoothly.
Another thing I found was, it was a bit, as we say in every conference, quite overwhelming, the number of people that were there to say hello to and enjoy and speak to, and just the amount of learning that was on offer. So I guess what we're hoping with these episodes is that if you were there and you missed some things, then maybe you can catch up. And if you weren't lucky enough to be able to get the study leave to go, or you were the hardworking people that were covering for us whilst we were there, then you can pick up on some of the learning points that we got.
Yeah, not least because FIS is pretty expensive as a conference goes, which makes it prohibitive for some. But if you can get the finance to go, I would say it's very worthwhile. So, Callum, will I kick us off?
No, I will kick us off by kicking to you. Yeah? See what I did there?
Okay.
So, Jane, I got to wax lyrical about some of the amazing sessions I got to go to, and I don't think we've really heard anything from you other than when you were interrupting the speakers and guests. Tell them your points about their
No, with my incredibly unwell, throaty voice.
Yeah, so James, you got to go to some sessions that I wanted to go to, but I was prohibited from going to on the... Oh, actually, anecdote time. Klaxon.
Oh, klaxon. Hang on a sec. Hang on.
Bah, 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 bah.
That's the anecdote klaxon.
No, the anecdote story is that Fizz 2023, Jane McRae, my co-host and the most organized person, set out a spreadsheet, itemized the timing, the rooms, incredible. Every session, which session he's going to, which session I'm going to, very well thought out. Turn up on the morning. Plenty of time. Sign in. Oh, we don't seem to have your name. Oh, I'm a speaker. You're not a speaker. Jane McRae has forgotten to register for the conference and had to do an emergency sign up. And they were very accommodating of this. But what I loved about it was that Jane had put so much thought and effort into doing this and like had done a great job of organizing the whole thing, but had fallen the very basic hurdle of signing up. So, James, after you eventually managed to get indoor through this sort of high security setting, one of the first sessions that you went to and I didn't go to was all about fungal infection.
Yeah, it was, amongst other things, fungal diagnostics. There was a lot of fungal stuff going on throughout the conference, not all of which I was able to attend. Previously, I spoke to Neil Stone. I wasn't able to get to his session. I was at something else. But fungal disease, there was a guy called Dr. Richardson who spoke about it, I think, on the first day. In the Hem-Onc session, and as you're aware, there are about 100,000 different species of fungi, but only about 500 that cause disease in humans or have been recorded to cause disease in humans, and of that, only about 100 that cause significant disease or are of relevance in the immunocompromised host, very rapidly you get down to only a few pathogens that you need to worry about, and that's dominated a lot by kind of Candida and Aspergillus. And more laterally, we've had this emergence of this thermotolerant pathogen, Candida auris, which has been kind of labelled by the WHO as this pathogen of extreme significance. And for the uninitiated, Candida auris is a extremely antifungal drug-resistant pathogen, which we are seeing more and more in the human population. It doesn't mean that it wasn't there before. As time has gone on over the 20th and now into the 21st century, human body temperature has been very gradually reducing. So, Callum, do you know what the average human body temperature is now, according to a recent study?
I would have said 36.5, but is that not right?
No, you're almost there. It's 36.6.
Oh.
In a population study, they took a bunch of GP registry data and pulled out all the people that had conditions that might cause them fever, and then said, what's the temperature? And it's 36.6. As human body temperature has been dropping, pathogens which previously were not able to grow in humans are now able to do it, because our main protection against fungi in general, and yeast in particular, is the fact that we're warm-blooded. So if we're less warm-blooded, then that means that fungi can colonize us more. And Candida auris, the outbreak, has all the appearances of that. First, there was an isolation in Japan, and then there was one somewhere else in Southeast Asia and then Africa, and none of these places had any connection with each other. It was just that as a world population, the body temperature is going down. And Candida auris in particular is it's as virulent as Candida albicans and as good at forming biofilm, but more tolerant of dryness and alcohol, so that, you know, they last longer on surfaces and they're more able to colonize the skin and the environment. And as I mentioned before, they're multi-drug resistant. And Neil Stone mentioned actually a pan-drug resistant auris strain, I think, that was somewhere in America, I think. So, yeah, and funguses or fungi love to live in sort of biofilms normally, and that's why they're such an issue with colonizing cannulas and all that sort of stuff. How are you going to diagnose them? And the talk that I was looking at was all about sort of fungal diagnostics. In particular, a lot of people were dumping on the beta-D-glucan, which I always like a little bit of dumping on beta-D-glucan. You know, people refer to it as a bit like a D-dimer. The D-dimer of fungal disease is a rule out, but if it's positive, it means nothing. You need to interpret it in context. And there was another talk talking about the different tests that you can use. So you can use microscopy, culture, blood culture for candidas and selected yeasts, beta-D-glucan and galactomat. And of the microscopy and culture were pretty sensitive and specific, but slow, and relied on skillful BMS, which might be difficult to maintain in smaller labs. Candida blood culture, the sensitivity is less than 40% for one culture, but if you start taking more and more for three sets, it's between 50 and 75%. They take a long time to grow, to go positive, though. You need to culture them for a long period of time. And for beta-D-glucan, I quite like the sort of list of differentials that a positive beta-D-glucan, they had a little list. And one was like a leaky gut, because of course you've got fungi living in your gut and the BDG will translocate just the same as microbes will. Cereals, there's a lot of beta-D-glucan on them. So if you've had your bran flakes or your Weetabix, you might get a false positive BDG. Presence of gauze in the body, TPN, things like that. And the other thing that I thought was quite interesting was that the galactomannan is very insensitive. It's like 40 to 60%, not very much. But in...
Is that on blood or in respiratory tracts?
That's the thing. In non-neutropenic patients, the benefits of a plasma galactomannan are highly doubtful, and they don't recommend doing it at all.
Yeah.
So those values are for like bowel galactomannan. So you're looking for mold or something that produces galactomannan. The specificity is quite high. If it's not there, it's not there. But for PLAS, if you're going to check it in the blood, it's really only worth doing it in the neutropenic population, sort of hem-onc population, say.
And is that just because your pre-test probability is much higher of having an invasive fungal disease?
I think so. So the sensitivity becomes worth it. But otherwise, you're better off just doing a bowel if you think it worthwhile. And I suppose the other thing is that in that population, you can get mold elsewhere.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Did they talk much about like their like PCR-based testing?
I think they did, Callum, but I didn't write it down.
Okay.
Sorry, pal.
That's okay. Yeah, I think beta-D-glucan can be really helpful. As of any test, we talked to Louis from Let's Talk Micro the other day about how do you do a test, and I mean, there's that textbook that we referred to. And it's all about the interpretation. Like sometimes we're like, it's not a useful test because it's got a high false positive rate or something. But half the battle is knowing. And I guess part of the difficulty is that you might, as a person who implements tests in your setting, be like, this test is good for ruling out fungal disease, BTD-GAN, but if it's positive, then there's lots of reasons for that. And how do you communicate that to your users who might see a test and be like, oh, that's a fungus test. Fungus test positive equal fungus. And really having interpretive comments and that clinical, like the discussion point being like, this is positive, but that's only 40% likely that they've got a fungal disease or whatever the specificity is.
Yeah. Why don't you tell me about something that you went to?
So one of the sessions that I went to was called Free Papers 2. There were several papers in that. They might be of useful learning points. So the first was Mo Kwok, who's a pharmacist who works in Chelsea and Westminster in London. And he was talking about their local implementation of a policy around linezolid and antidepressant use. And I was very interested in this, as with many people who would have seen the recent meta-analysis that looked at the risks of, basically with linezolid, which is an oxazolidinone antimicrobial, it has a weak monoamine oxidase inhibitor effect. And so when it's co-prescribed with some medications, there's a risk of serotonin syndrome. And this is something that has historically has been a major concern with linezolid. And essentially, I think most centers' practice has been to say, if you're on one of these drugs, we will not give you linezolid. And actually, a lot of people are on antidepressants. A lot of people are on SSRIs, yeah. SNRIs. Very few people are on monoamine oxidase inhibitors directly as an antidepressant class now. It's very historical. People are on methadone. There's a whole long list, which I'm sure Jamie...
People take tramadol as well?
Tramadol, yeah. There's a long list of these drugs, which would be like, you're not getting linezolid. And particularly in an era when there's a lot of vancomycin-resistant enterococci around, or we're looking for oral switch options for people with complicated gram-positive disease, and linezolid would be an option, and I certainly have practiced this before. But I think the more recent data is saying, actually, that risk has been overstated. The risk increases with you being on more of these agents. But if you're on just, say, one antidepressant and linezolid, your risk of serotonin syndrome isn't really significantly increased and it should be safe. But I think the difficulty I find, like I know that, and then when you try and practice that way, you hit up against the barrier of, oh, this is the product information sheet says we can't prescribe these. Or
there's an auto alert in your prescribing
system.
Yeah,
exactly.
Or a pharmacist flag it up, or intensive care have tried it before and heard that you can't use linezolid.
Yeah. Or there's been what someone's like, I co-prescribed these drugs and someone had serotonin syndrome. That anecdotal data comes in as well.
Yeah.
Who's to say that actually if they didn't get linezolid, would they still got serotonin syndrome? We don't know. That's what the value of the sort of bigger, you know, higher quality evidence is.
But data has been building more and more over the past, like just the past 3 or 4 years, that the signal is probably not there, that meta-analysis.
Yeah, and that's a problem
with the last thing.
Like drug safety trials, when they come in, is that often you get into a state where one person reports and then it snowballs, and it is hard to unpick then, is this a true drug effect or, you know, it's not a controlled, level, it's not a controlled thing. Anyway. So what they were talking about was, okay, we acknowledge this, we're going to create a local implementation where we say, this is the policy and we're going to do it. And we're going to say to people, you can co-prescribe linezolid antidepressants. And it was a very pharmacy-led project. So the pharmacists were coming in, they were giving advice, and it was a sort of mandatory pharmacy-led review of the risk and whether it was allowed or not. And it was a sort of enabling our pharmacist colleagues to come in and take that role and say, okay, this is the data, this is the risk. We can do it here, or in this patient, they're on too many drugs with this effect, we can't do it. And it was just one thing that interests me a lot as someone who isn't really a researcher is dipped my toes into the pool of research, but then took them out because it was too cold, is the implementation of evidence. So ECMID, I think we talked about this. I talked about this on the podcast, which was one of the sessions was all about the timeline between you get data from research, it gets into guidelines, it changes clinical practice. And it was about 10 years, like 5 years between each step. And this really was like an example of implementation science. Like, how do we get from the evidence, the guideline, to actually changing clinical practice? So I just thought it was a really nice, nicely presented bit of work to say to others, and actually, this is possible and you could do it. James, that was a little bit about linezolid, which I chose as a topic close to your heart. Let's talk about a really unusual thing that nobody working in infection would ever see, Staphylococcus aureus.
Oh, Staph aureus indeed. This was the session that you and me both attended, and sitting in the audience, it may well have been the most well-attended session at all of this, because it opened with Dr. or Professor, I can't remember, Kim Cash presenting the Sabato trial. So Sabato, we've seen, it's had a couple of results presented over the past couple of years. I think it was presented at one of the ID weeks over the past couple of years, and I think there was something at ECMID. It's getting close to publication now, and the final results are up, and it's actually been published as a preprint, which we've read. We've talked about at Calm, although we've not published our episode on it yet. So the Sabato trial was a trial compared therapy for uncomplicated Staph aureus bacteremia versus an early oral switch, so that day 5 or day 7, so that the second week of therapy is completed with highly bioavailable orals. And those were cotrimoxazole, linezolid, and clindamycin at set doses. It was conducted and run from 2013 to 2019 in Europe, and it was a non-inferiority trial, and it met non-inferiority criteria, and he was presenting it here at FIS. It was really very interesting, and there's lots more to say about it, and we will release a journal club episode on it. I was lucky enough to be able to chat to him afterwards, and he was really generous with his time. I didn't want to impose on him further by asking him to schlep across the conference center to come chat at our little podcast station. I asked him a couple of questions. For example, for MSSA, you could use Cotrim or clindamycin, and for MRSA, you could use Cotrim or linezolid. And I didn't really understand what the difference was there, like why, and I'd been itching to ask him. And so I did, and the answer was really that in 2013, when they were cooking up the protocol, linezolid was new and it was expensive, and so it was held back for MRSA, and so they just worked that into the, seems that they just worked into the protocol. And then I asked him, like, would you use all three of these for MSSA, MRSA? Would you discount that when thinking about which agent to use? And he said yes, basically. In his personal practice, he wouldn't discriminate between the three.
It's really interesting. We talked about this in the Stenotrophomonas episode recently, that when you have these, when you run a clinical trial of something that's quite hard to recruit to, so it takes a long time to run the study, sometimes when you get to the end and publish something, people, e.g. us, are like, oh, why did they do that? We knew that already, or that seems really outdated.
Yeah, no, you know it now. You didn't know it 10 years ago. Yeah. This Sabato like, started 10 years
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, oh, that's quite a long time ago. So fair play that some bits might seem a bit odd later on. But yeah. I was really impressed listening to that. And I think most people were, to be honest, about how difficult it was to run that. And obviously now, and James had the opportunity to speak to one of the leads of the SNAP trial, which is really...
That's already blown all the other Staph aureus trials that have ever existed out of the water in terms of recruitment.
Yeah.
It's very ambitious, but those kind of adaptive platform trials and things like recovery.
Yeah. Oh my God, recovery.
We've only just started doing those. Like, we should have been doing them all along, sure, but we've only just started doing them. Sabato It was under-recruited, right? They were meant to get 450 and they closed at 225 participants. You know, up until relatively recently, it's been really difficult to get people for trials like that because some people were adamant that if you didn't give people IV therapy, you may as well start digging their grave then, there and there. So anyway, that was a real treat to listen to that as well. Callum, over to you.
The next thing on my list of things to talk about was the one of the keynote speeches was by the very eminent Mary Worrell, part of a very famous infection family, all about rabies and how do we prevent rabies treatment. And there was a couple of things I took away as key learning points. Never having seen anybody or managed anybody with rabies, fortunately, it was a real, the experience and knowledge of the speaker really came across as someone who just had a lot of respect, I guess, for how devastating a disease this is and also how global a disease it is. I guess my experience is in a high income country, either delivering pre or post exposure prophylaxis to people that probably don't have rabies and sometimes kind of laughably remote risk, like someone recently presented where they'd moved a bat with their hat on holiday and then put the hat on their head and then they were worried about rabies, which is the level of anxiety that rabies can invoke that people they get a bit spooked about it. And a couple of key things was, one, she said this nice quote, which was, pre-exposure vaccination against rabies is a lifelong investment, and really just plugging that as the real key. The second bit was that really rabies vaccination is a luxury product and that the vaccines are not equally distributed and not in the right places and is a very expensive intervention for many. And so how do we maximize the benefit of vaccination and how do we best use the limited resources that are available in low and middle income countries is really key, which segued into her point about what type of post-exposure prophylaxis to use and really thinking hard about how do we use the minimum amount of vaccine to get the best amount of response. And the best way to study that is to look at antibody levels and really saying actually intradermal vaccination, which is slightly different from a lot of the default, I guess, would be IM. Using intradermal seems to lead to higher levels of antibody production. And so there's a rationale to move to a lower number of visits where you turn up and you get multi-site intradermal injection with smaller doses of vaccine, which leads to higher levels of antibody response. And so you then can take a vial of vaccine instead of using one vial for one person, you can then split it across other people. And the benefit of having less visits is that you're less likely to waste vaccine. So if you're having to come back at day 0, 3, 7, 20, 14, 21, whatever the number that you pick out in your protocol, having less visits and giving more vaccine means that you're less likely to waste it.
And you get less loss to follow up.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it was really, really interesting. And then the other bit that she talked about, and she's published several papers on rabies, one talking about the rationale for intradermal post-exposure prophylaxis. The other one was really saying that the management of rabies clinical disease is palliative and not to go down, you know, there's not really a successful therapy. Now, her point was that once you develop the disease, the key is good palliative therapy and not giving people false hope. And it felt like a really... it was realistic medicine that she was talking about. And it was quite, you were in that talk as well, were you not?
Yeah.
It was quite like a, it felt like a talk of another age in some ways. I'm not sure if I can say that or not. We gave some talks there and it was like jazzy slides and interactive for Learning Fury. And this was a very like traditional PowerPoint slides, pictures, text, old fashioned formatting, but of someone that was just like, I know what I'm talking about. Here is all the stuff I've done. And it was quite moving, I felt, as well. So, James, I wanted to ask you about a session, which was called, Personalized PKPD, was that it? It was a debate.
Yeah, it was a really interesting debate. It was by the UKCPA, UK Clinical Pharmacists Association. And it was the role of personalized antimicrobial dosing, PKPD and dose based on MIC, a pro and con debate, and that was between Robert Oakley, who was pro, and Stephen Hughes, who was con. I don't know either of these guys, but the talk that they put on, or the debate that they put on, was really impressive. And the thing about it is, you know, what are we talking about here? You know, usually when we give antibiotics, we give them in set doses and we ignore people's weight unless it's an absolute extreme. We ignore their sex, their gender. We don't take levels except for gentamicin, vancomycin, and a couple of others. And the debate was about whether or not we should use our knowledge of PKPD to personalize a little bit more. And so there's been, people have been thinking about this, and particularly with beta-lactams, because with beta-lactams, your PKPD sort of target is time over MIC. And for some pathogens, that matters more than others. So for Pseudomonas, you're wanting to get time over MIC for a lot of the drugs, at least according to UCAST, of 60 to 70%. Whereas with other pathogens, that might be closer to 40 to 50%. Say for streptococcal infection, it would be 40 to 50. But for Staph aureus, a lot of the time, it's people want a little bit more. And so people have thought to themselves, we can take beta-lactam levels. At the moment, if you want to do it, you have to go and send it off to Bristol. But it is possible to do them in-house. Could we use that to target treatments? And so there have been three sort of RCTs. There was the Target trial, which was looking at beta-lactams. There was the Dolphin trial, which was looking at ciprofloxacin. And most recently, there was the Mercy trial, which is the only one of these that I've actually read. And that was looking at meropenem in intensive care. Almost all of these were done in sort of ITU settings for serious sepsis. And the reason that they did it is because the observational data said that there was a decrease in mortality if you did this. And so people started plugging it into randomized controlled trials. And every single one of them has been negative to date. And I'll just talk about the Mercy trial because that's the only one that I sort of in depth. I think it was for VAPS and HAPS. But don't quote me. And it was meropenem 1 gram 3 times a day. And they would either give it as your normal dose, or they would give it over 3 hours. And the idea for that is that you've got, if you're giving it 3 times a day for 3 hours, that's 9 hours in which the meropenem level in the blood is going up. So you get this slow increase to the peak and then you go down. So you don't get that peak and then the half, because it's going down by a half-life. If you prolong your time to the peak, then you're prolong the time that you're going to be above the MIC. And this is why UCAST, incidentally, when you're giving it 2 grams in severe infections, they recommend giving it over 3 hours is to optimize the time over MIC.
The difficult to treat gram-negative infection guidance is often a recommendation for prolonged infusion or a continued infusion, carbapenem, even in carbapenem-resistant organisms because of this theoretical.
And this is because you want to increase your PTA, your probability of target attainment. But the Mercy trial would state that that there is no link between attaining these PKPD targets and mortality. Now, there are issues with all of these trials, and most recently the Mercy trial, that it's a dosing issue. And there they fall victim to starting the trial before the recommendation was changed. So at the time, using meropenem 1 gram 3 times a day was more common than it is now. There are some other sort of kind of logistical issues which I've temporarily forgotten, but they kind of give enough doubt to the point where the door's not been closed completely on this question. And, you know, what would be ideal is if the Mercy trial was repeated, but with meropenem 2 grams and a couple of other sort of logistical tweaks to see if that made any difference. But right now, you've got to say that even though there is observational data that this might decrease your mortality, there's no RCT evidence of saying. But the back and forth between these guys was really interesting to listen to. The old idea of optimizing your PKPD, this is what led the Hartford Hospital to change their gentamicin nomogram to once a day, 5 mg/kg, instead of 1.66, 3 times a day, which is the same dose, but split into three. And they got this vast improvement in side effect profile. But one of the points one of the guys made was no improvement in outcomes. And we can tweak the PKPD of the drugs that we use But at the moment, there's no evidence that we can improve the outcome based on that. We might be able to improve the side effects like we did with gentamicin. And some people argue that AUC over MIC dosing for vancomycin instead of just setting a trough will lead to better outcomes. There do seem to be a few studies which support that, although other people would counter-argue and say that the use of the 15 to 20 range for vancomycin for serious infection is based on really shonky data. And so they would argue that if you just use 10 to 15, there may not be a benefit of switching to AUC over MIC dosing calculations.
Yeah.
And that was about it, really.
Yeah, so I guess we've wrapped up. We've wrapped up FIS for this year. Hopefully we will get to go back in the future and go to some more conferences and take you some...
Oh, I'd love to.
Take home.
And I guess we should also say that we presented on the podcast as well, didn't we?
We had some... James made lots of unscripted jokes and puns, and I was there as well. There was some data presented, and I think it went down well with the wonderful watchers, as James termed them, right, which was a nice thing. So that was, it was very great. Very nice to have some people there, and slightly more daunting than this, which is us recording into the void. There are actual real people there watching, and we couldn't just edit out our ums and ahs.
Yeah, true. But it was, you know, it was nice to go and report on the first 2 years of the podcast. And for those that didn't attend, we're now over 100,000 downloads. So we're a podcast proper, I feel.
Okay.
All right, Cal. See you again, man.
Thanks.